Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Caroline O'Donoghue. Welcome to Our Shelves, Caroline. It's such a pleasure to have you here as we kick off another season of the podcast.
Thank you so much, Lucy. And I'm actually reminded that I think that the first ever event in publishing I ever did, you hosted.
Was that your first event?
Yeah.
The one we did at Waterstones Gower Street back in the day?
Yes. With, I think it was Sophie McIntosh and Charlene Teo were the other panellists.
That was it. It was a debut fiction event, wasn't it? And you three just had novels out. So that must have been your first one, Promising Young Women. Is that right?
It was,
back in 2018.
Yeah. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, you're very welcome.
You sort of really launched me on my maiden voyage into this sort of world of having a public-facing career. And it was a great, you know, you were a great deflowerer.
It's all down to me. Your wonderful career. You can count on me for everything that you've achieved since then. I'm going to take credit for it. Well, I'm not going to take credit for Caroline's career because she is a New York Times bestselling author and the host of the award-winning podcast Sentimental Garbage. Her first novel, Promising Young Woman, which I interviewed her about back in the day, was shortlisted for a post-Irish Book Awards Sunday Independent Newcomer of the Year. And her second, Scenes of a Graphic Nature, was longlisted for the Ondaatje Prize. She's also the author of All Our Hidden Gifts, a supernatural series for teenagers. And just this month, Virago is publishing your third novel for adults, The Rachel Incident. So congratulations, Caroline. It always feels a bit strange saying a novel for adults, as if I'm kind of implying it's some sort of X-rated story, but that's not the case.
It is funny. Yeah, I have to make that distinction all the time as well, of like when people ask me who I write for, I always start with, well, I do sort of serialized fantasy for teenagers and books for adults. And it does sound like it's behind a kind of a beaded curtain or something.
Yes, can only be got in very specialised shops in Soho.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Do you find though when you're writing them, do you have to put on sort of different hats, as it were, or do you use the same? I mean, how do you sort of distinguish between yourself as a writer for adults and a writer for teenagers? Or is there really no difference in your mind?
I don't see it as being a huge difference, really. I think that I've sort of come to think of the trilogy, the All Our Hidden Gifts trilogy, which I had to produce quite quickly. Because no one sort of tells you when you start writing, when you sign on to do a trilogy for teenagers, that those books need to be produced at quite a clip, because you really need to get a YA series on the shelves, like completed, while that initial generation are able to enjoy it, because the things that you enjoy at 13 aren't necessarily what you enjoy at 17, and you can't...
I never thought of that, but of course.
I had never thought of that either, and so...
Wow.
Yeah, so I sort of did three quite long books in sort of 4 years, and that alongside sort of doing the adult stuff as well. And it was, I've sort of started referring to it in my head as kind of like an MFA I was paid for, because when you're producing at that kind of a clip and you're, it's fantasy, so it has to be these big, big storylines that really continue to both sort of continue the themes and also raise the stakes of the things that went on before it. And also because it's YA and because you're dealing with quite a small cast of characters, there's really only about six characters in these books. You sort of, the characterization has to just get deeper and deeper and deeper as you go through these books. And obviously they're young people, so they're evolving all the time. And so what it sort of feels like as a writer is that like this very, very intense sort of bracket of time. And what was also lovely about it is most of my peers, my friends, like I live in London, I moved here when I was 21. Most of my friends are sort of writers, creatives in the media, in and out. They don't, they're the best friends in the world. They don't read YA fantasy. And so most of my friends are like, oh, I must get around to reading your book. It's like, it's fine. It's not for you. It's fine.
Yeah.
But it was sort of lovely to have this bracket of both time and work to sort of learn how I like to write novels, I guess, because I think it really sort of taught me that, you know, how to sort of really manage big plots, how to manage characters that, you know, appear very ordinary but have sort of a deeper kind of thing going on, and how to sort of create a plot that is as a result of the character's actions as opposed to the other way around, I guess. Which is not to sort of bastardize my earlier work promising or scenes at all, but I do feel like there's something about being crunched into that sort of time that you do emerge as a different writer. And so I don't really see them as being separate arms, but more as like separate schools where I'm constantly feeding back into what I'm learning from one into the other.
Mm. That's so interesting, because I was thinking while I was reading The Rachel Incident, which I very much enjoyed, about, and I remember reading, you know, Scenes of a Graphic Nature when that came out, and Promising Young Woman, and loved those. But there did seem something about The Rachel Incident that I was aware that you had maybe, you'd sort of grown up a little bit as a writer, like the writing had a sort of accomplished feel to it that maybe wasn't quite there in your kind of first works, which is wonderful when I think as a reader you're able to see a writer's kind of, you know, growing into it. And one of the things we're probably going to come up against now when we talk about The Rachel Incident is that it is a very well-plotted, quite plot-heavy book in the sense of lots of different things got to click into action. But it feels so dynamic when I was reading it. It felt very seamless in that way, like you'd spent a long time very cleverly and meticulously plotting it to make it kind of come across like that. Or do you think you'd learnt that on the job of writing these the teenage fiction?
Yeah, I think it was very learned on the job, and I'm very proud of The Rachel Incident for that reason. I think on a craft level it's the best thing I've ever done. It feels really awful to sort of like self-pat your back about that kind of stuff. It feels gross, but you have to do it, I suppose. But it's like,
well, no, I mean, you've worked hard at it clearly, and it's, you know, and I think recognizing that is also important as a writer. You need to understand when you've got something right and what are your strengths.
Yes,
surely.
Yeah, no, you're right. And like and you're right, it is sort of satisfying to look back on a sort of a career and see the places where you've grown, and I sort of like to reassure myself and think that like I know I've written 6 books or whatever, but statistically, I could still be very much at the beginning of my career. You know, I hope I'm doing this when I'm Margaret Atwood's age, you know. So, but sorry, that's avoiding the question. But what I'm proud of The Rachel Incident is that there's a lot. It's a very quotidian, quite ordinary book about very ordinary people. And there's lots of details that are sort of dropped about what various people are interested in or suffering from or whatever that feel like colour, but then actually become everything actually is very crucial, like things that people are reading or doing or not doing or whatever that feel like just breezy daytime activity. Everything plays a little role, and I'm really proud of that. But I spent the least amount of time with this book sitting down and plotting it, and I didn't write a detailed overview, which I've done for every other book I've written. Something about it was like, I think because with this book I had the most faith in the characters in the setting than I ever had before, because I was not afraid to both draw from real experiences and also to twist those experiences. I think before maybe there was a certain kind of level of anxiety of like, you know, the kind of classic thing of like, oh, women are always accused of writing about themselves or whatever. And that's kind of now become this glib line in kind of female publishing discourse of like, oh, we accuse women of never being able to make things up. And now I think we've gone the other direction with that discourse, where it's now like if somebody is using their life to inform their fiction, we kind of don't know what to do with it a bit. We're like, don't know whether to treat it as a fact or fiction or whatever. And I think, you know, and so I had a huge faith in the characters in the setting because they were based on people I knew. But I also had huge faith in myself to just invent things and not try. I feel like I'm talking in circles. But with Scenes of a Graphic Nature, my second novel, I felt like I was in such a rush to show people how much I could invent that it sort of ended up having a lot of sort of snake arms, sort of like kind of, there was a lot of snakes coming out of that beast. And I think I had a sort of a more relaxed idea going into this one, and probably a more confident idea, and I didn't feel, and the plot just sort of naturally seemed to emerge. Sorry, that probably sounds really incoherent.
No, I think that makes perfect sense. I mean, it's I think it's an incredible achievement then, because it, like I say, it's so meticulously plotted, and there are so many points in it where something would happen, which I'm not going to sort of give away any spoilers, and I go, oh, and then you think, then everything that you've been reading before clicks back into gear, and you think, oh, it has been leading to this, but I didn't realize at the time, which is so cleverly done, I think.
Oh, thank you, Lucy. And actually, the most rewarding things I've heard about this book so far from, you know, NetGalley reviewers or whatever, have been like, oh, I finished it and then I sort of started it again, sort of that thing of, you know, oh, now that I know everything, you know.
Yes, I could see that. It would be a very, very satisfying book to go back to the beginning of and then trace it through in a, and you'd almost, you know, be able to see the story happening and kind of recognize these little bits as it went along. I feel like we are talking weirdly about this book that many of our listeners won't have had a chance to read yet because it's only just come out. Could you give us a sort of very brief synopsis?
Yes, The Rachel Incident is set in mostly in 2009, 2010 in Cork City, which is the city where I'm from. And it tells the story of a young woman called Rachel, who's sort of, she's, you know, 21 years old or whatever. And she's kind of, she's sort of too young to be as old as she is a bit. Is always how I think of her. She's sort of, the economic recession has really devastated Ireland at this point. Her sort of parents are in a lot of financial trouble. She's going to university in the town where she grew up in, and because of this, there's a sense, and she's also, you know, she's still with a boyfriend she's been with since sort of mid-secondary school, and there's just kind of, she's a very heavy sort of weighted down character at the beginning who sort of doesn't quite know how lonely and bored she is, until she works at a bookshop called O'Connor's, and she meets another young man called James, who's working as a Christmas temp, and her first assumption of when she meets James is that he's obviously gay, because he just has an energy and a verve and a wit and a campness to him that's so instantly magnetic, and I think is particularly magnetic to young women who haven't discovered themselves yet. They're sort of, it's like this electric current that wakes them up, and it certainly wakes her up, and they become best friends very quickly. They move in together. And then I think often when you have a new best friend at that age, what's really important early on is that you have some kind of sort of blood pact happen. If not literally, then figuratively, and their sort of figurative blood pact is that she kind of confesses to him that she's you know, obsessed with her literature professor, this man called Dr. Byrne. James finds this really exciting and fun. And so they sort of plan this book launch for Dr. Byrne's unreadable book.
His very heavy tome about the Irish famine.
Yes, and its effects on the art world. and they hold this book launch for him with the view for Rachel to seduce him, and then when crunch time comes, and this is about 80 pages in, so it's not much of a spoiler, Dr. Byrne ends up getting with James rather than Rachel, and then what kind of unfolds is the sort of like coming of age novel about the two of them and the secrets they're sort of forced to uphold for one another, and the sort of various betrayals, lies and things that follow as they get sort of closer and closer to both Dr. Byrne and his wife.
I was thinking the story is in so many ways that story of the friendship, the importance of it, and everything you're saying about that way that you make those bonds, particularly when you meet someone who you just click with instantly and you're still sort of finding yourself. Those things are so timeless. And yet there are obviously other things, other elements in this novel that make it so specific. You've already mentioned like the economic recession of 2008, and that's what the characters are all dealing with in different ways. And that idea of being young in Ireland at that point and not maybe having the future in front of you, or the prospects of the future in front of you that you might had, you know, envisaged for yourself earlier on. But also there is an element of there's a bit of the narrative that brings us up to the present day. I won't go into too many details here, but at a certain point, I think it's okay to mention that Rachel has been working in London for a while in the 2010s. And at that point, she's a journalist and she's been writing a lot about abortion, hasn't she? It becomes a kind of, you know, a big topic that as an Irish writer, an Irish journalist at that time, she has to cover. And I was just thinking, because I remember when we first met for that first event that you were doing, it was maybe like a week before Repeal the Eighth, and I remember you telling me at the time about how many Irish people you knew in London who were flying back to vote in the referendum, many women, obviously men as well. And I was thinking about how much the sort of weight of that history is in this novel, tied in very kind of, you know, nuanced ways. But it seems like it's impossible to write about this sort of period of sort of Irish history without bringing this into it. Did you find that?
Yes, it's so funny how I'm like, yes, I just remembered that we spoke about that at that event back in 2018. And then I was wearing my Repeal the Eighth t-shirt.
Yeah, you gave me a badge. Yes. I still got it now. Yes.
I had a big stack of badges that said TOR on them, which is Irish for yes, and yes to Repeal the Eighth. And I remember at my signing table, I had a big stack of badges and was giving everyone to everyone. And and I was among the people who flew back as well. And I can say that now. I couldn't say that for years because it was actually illegal to do that.
Sorry.
Rumbled me. No, but I mean, I can say it now. But yeah, because we had the marriage equality vote in, I think, 2015. And I think an enormous amount of people flew home for that. And then there seemed to be a pushback. And this was kind of, which is kind of, I guess, in essence, a kind of fair thing of like, well, the future of the country should not be dictated by people who don't live in it, which I mean obviously I voted for marriage equality as well, but I do understand that as a theory. So they kind of clamped back on people flying home to vote, and so I had to sort of illegally do it by pretending that I still lived in the country, and it was all very cloak and dagger. It was a very exciting time. But yes, to answer your question, I don't think there's any, you can't overstate how much Irish abortion laws factor into the art of Irish women, I think. And maybe Irish men too, although I haven't spoken about it with them as much. I think because, especially sort of my generation or whatever, so you really grow up, obviously as a teenager, sort of obsessed with sex. And we're kind of, we grew up in this kind of very specific time. And I think this is probably why I go back to this time a lot in my podcast as well, and maybe everyone's just obsessed with the time that they themselves were young, in the kind of turn of the century, sort of, you know, Paris Hilton and kind of celebrity sex tapes and raunch culture and Playboy phone charms and all that. That was all part of it. We were getting that as much as everybody else was. But we were also living in this time that was just starting to emerge from like this incredible sexual repression, to the extent where it was incredibly hard to get, you know, birth control in the country, illegal to get birth control in the country unless you were a married woman until I think the mid 80s. I don't know, I don't have my dates right, but, you know, very late, you know, the last Magdalen laundry in Ireland closed in 1996, which is where women who were pregnant outside of wedlock could be sort of incarcerated for their entire lives. Like this, and obviously, and, you know, the morning after pill, extremely expensive and hard to get. Even when I was a teenager, when I had to get the morning after pill when I was about 17. And I remember I went around to all my friends and I collected money from them, you know, because it was about 85 euros or something like that. Like a nuts amount of money for a teenager. It was complicated to get, and you had to go to like several consultations. It was mad. Especially when you think of it like the time frame of the morning after pill when you have to take it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you haven't got an awful lot of time to get that money and then to go, you know, actually jump through hoops to get it, right? It's not like just walking into a chemist. Yeah,
you couldn't get in a chemist. You had to make an appointment at a clinic or whatever. Anyway, and then obviously the kind of the crown jewel in all of this anxiety that's also rubbing up against this culture that's becoming rapidly sexualized is that if you have sex and if you get pregnant, you will have to go to England to get an abortion. And if you were thinking about that concept around the time that you're trying to lose your virginity desperately, like say 16, 17, 18, you know, that is the psychological weight that is just this constant burden on you, because where would you get the money? You'd have to tell your parents. You know, I mentioned this in the Rachel incident. There was a referendum in 2005, I think, to legalize abortion in the small number of cases where the life of the mother is threatened. And even in that case, it didn't pass. So that was all of our parents. I think my parents now are very, and that generation in general, are very convinced that abortion is a necessary thing within a society. But back then, they weren't so convinced. It was just the vibe. And I think when you were growing up at that kind of a crossroads, it can't not influence the kind of art that you make, which is why I think we see so much of like sex and reproduction within Irish millennial novelists. Like I think we're obsessed with it. And it's just what we, yeah, it's what we go through. So abortion has been the most, one of the most emotional and artistic, you know, centerpieces of my life without me ever having one, you know, like, which is such a fascinating thing to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would encourage all of our listeners to go out, get your copy of The Rachel Incident ASAP, and I guarantee that you'll all love it. Caroline, let's jump into the main questions now. I'm going to start off by asking, what books are currently on your nightstand?
So I'm reading two books at the moment, and they're very different. One of them is The Female Persuasion by Meg Wolitzer, and the other one is Lunar Park by Bret Easton Ellis. And my Wolitzer one is, I went on holidays recently and I read The Interestings and I just thought it was phenomenal. I don't know if you...
Was that the first time you'd read her?
Yes, it was. Yeah. I couldn't believe, like, where has this woman been all my life? And that's that fabulous feeling of being like, there's all these books and I just get to read them. Because she's got like eight or nine books and I get to read them all in my own time. And The Female Persuasion is interesting, and about halfway through, maybe three quarters of the way through, but it's dealing with a subject I find fascinating and have tried and failed to write about, which is, and actually very relevant to Virago, I think, which is what happens when you try and make an ideological movement such as feminism into a capitalist venture, which, you know, I mean, that's what Virago is, you know, it's like, it's not, you know, selling books, you know, it's selling books for a profit. And I find that such an interesting schism. And that's very much what The Female Persuasion is about sort of a young woman going to work at sort of a feminist second waiver kind of business and the sort of various sort of conflicts of that. But I find it fascinating because I worked at a website called The Pool a few years ago, which it's funny, it meant a lot at the time, but it's funny as time passes how little it comes to mean, like less and less people remember it, do you know what I mean? But at that,
it was huge. I remember it being huge, but yes, you're right, I haven't thought about it recently, let's say, whereas everyone used to write for it and it was such a big deal.
Yeah it was a big deal for about, you know, four years. It was a big deal. It did a lot of incredibly admirable things, and one of the things that was so admirable about it is, like, nobody in the British press covers the Irish abortion referendum quite as thoroughly as The Pool did. Like, because there was a lot of Irish members of staff there, like, and I was one of them, and
nice,
you know, and there was lots of news that we covered that was important and not being covered anywhere else. But also, it was a capitalist venture, and there was lots of stuff that we covered or there wasn't time to research or do due diligence on. There's a lot of reactionary stuff, a lot of, like, you know, the Daily Mail has published a picture of Kate Middleton sunbathing topless on her holidays, and now we're going to republish the same photograph, but under the headline of, like, can you believe the Daily Mail is running this? Do you know what I mean? It's like, and I found, like, like, it's sort of this have your cake eating it too, that's kind of necessary when you're trying to run a business for profit. Anyway, so that's what Female Persuasion is about. And I find that subject fascinating, and I'd like to really get into it in my own work, but I've kind of not been able to so far. Maybe it's something to do with distance. And then Lunar Park.
The day will come. You'll get there. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I tried to, but I think maybe in 10 years I'll have a better idea.
Yeah, you just need to let it sort of sift and settle, and then you'll have a brilliant novel about it, I'm sure, at some point.
Yeah.
So don't worry. Don't rush it.
Okay, I think you're right. I do think you're right.
And what about Lunar Park? Tell me about this one. I haven't read, this is an embarrassing admission of mine, but I don't think I've ever read any Bret Easton Ellis.
So I think it's embarrassing that I'm reading him now.
Okay. Well, we'll both be embarrassed together about it then.
Yes, because he had, like, you know, he's really become one of those, he was the kind of the enfant terrible of the kind of the 80s or whatever. And now he's just sort of an old man who sits on his porch and yells. And but between that, those two periods, that he published a book in 2005, I think, called Lunar Park. And it is kind of what I find fascinating about it. And I'm kind of interested in these kinds of novels a lot lately since writing The Rachel Incident, because The Rachel Incident begins with a kind of a memo from Rachel saying that she was never interested in writing books. And you know, once you read the story, you'll kind of understand why. And so I liked positioning the Rachel incident as a book where you're challenging the reader to possibly think this might be a memoir, or possibly, you know what I mean? Okay. And that's very exciting to me when authors do that. And Lunar Park is a version of that where he's writing as Bredy Snellis, as this kind of washed up enfant terrible of the 80s, now in a kind of a post 9/11 upstate New York situation where he's, you know, a drug addict. He's trying to have a family. It's not going well. His father has just died. He's dealing with the aftermath of American Psycho, where there's all these kind of copycat killings of people who've been inspired by Patrick Bateman. And he's kind of dealing with kind of the terrible things he's wrought on the world. And then simultaneously, it becomes sort of a haunted house novel of like the house is sort of turning on him that he's trying to live in and trying to be just a famous novelist. And it's very Stephen King-y, but also just very sort of juicy and gossipy. And I haven't flown through. I started it on, it's Monday now. I started on Saturday. I'm almost finished. Like, it's so good.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is it making you want to read other novels by him, or do you think you'll...
I don't know. He's just got a new one out right now.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. I heard a lot of people talking about it recently, obviously.
Yeah, he published an essay collection provocatively titled Whites about 2 years ago.
Yes.
And it's very, it's very just like, oh, the young today, they're all about their identity politics and their blah, 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 whatever happened to people being mean and, you know, that kind of, and it's just so, it's such a boring point of view, but I'm trying to get back into reading people who I don't agree with, I guess, maybe. Because I think I may have bubbled myself off by reading a lot of sort of like-minded individuals. And I think it's sort of good to challenge yourself with work you appreciate, who the people you don't necessarily agree with. And I am sort of enjoying that. And I think the book he's just published, The Shards, he said something really interesting about it. Someone asked him why he's obsessed with serial killers, because it's another one about serial killers. He says, I think serial killers are kind of similar to authors in a way, in that they impose their narrative on everybody else and they will stop at nothing until it's observed.
Wow.
And I thought that was just a great line. And like, and he was like, yeah.
And you recognised yourself in it and you thought.
Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah.
I'm seen.
yeah, it me.
Next up, I'm going to ask you about a recent film or podcast, TV show or article that's made you think. I think you've got a couple of potentials for me, haven't you?
Yes. One of them was the recent long read in Vanity Fair with Caroline Calloway.
How much do you know, Caroline? Do you know
everything?
Okay. Okay. In like 2 minutes, can you summarize Caroline Calloway for anyone who doesn't know her?
Oh, what a challenge. Okay, Caroline Calloway was a Instagram influencer who was a young American woman living in Cambridge, I think. She's gone to university in Cambridge. She was one of the first people, young people, to really take advantage of Instagram as a platform, and sort of like wrote a lot of long romantic captions, and she looks a bit like Sienna Miller, so like lovely kind of thing. And that in itself, incredibly boring. And that's the thing with Caroline Calloway. All these individual things that she does are not fascinating of themselves, but they string, all these beads string together to make this fascinating portrait of a human being that I cannot look away from. So she sort of reneged on a publishing deal, a huge publishing deal, and then she sort of paid her publisher back by going on OnlyFans and recreating great literary figures, but completely nude. Her best friend published a long read in The Cut about how she's this abusive friend and all this, all just kind of mad stuff. And this Vanity Fair article, she used to be this New York party girl. She's one of the big kind of jokes about her is that she has promised her fans countless books at this point. She'll say, this book is coming out in May, and then she'll release a sort of a designed cover that she herself has made and has clearly not gone through a publisher. And she's like, it's going to be a 400-page epic. Get ready, folks, or whatever. And then 6 months will go by. And then she'll say, actually, it's not a 400-page epic. It's a really prose poetry, more like haikus. And then 6 months will go by and nothing. And the kind of the joke is sort of the book will never happen, because the book will almost, it'll be the end of the story once there's actually a tangible thing. And so much of her charm almost is that it's just this ephemeral ghost person who can't quite be touched or something. And she is currently living in Florida. In her grandmother died recently. She had been looking after her grandmother. She's now sort of grey gardensing with her in her grandmother's sort of Florida condo. She had not moved out any of this stuff, but she's moved her own stuff in on top of the old granny stuff, you know.
Yep, she's living in like a retirement complex, isn't she? And she's in her 20s.
Every move is more unpredictable than the last. And so one of the things that the journalist, and it's a fabulous piece of journalism just from a prose point of view, I think, she's in a dispute with her landlord, her ex-landlord, who she lived in New York, and it turned out she did not pay her rent for 2 years. And she owed her landlord $40,000. And she, I don't know if you've heard the piece, but she starts off saying, kind of, she makes a joke about herself and she says, oh yeah, well, that's the price of living a nice life, I guess. And then she sort of stops herself mid kind of answer and she says, you know what? No, I wanted to be an it girl. It girls are startups and startups need funding. And she's like, the money I should have used on my rent, I sort of became a sort of an it girl, a sort of a brand, a thing. Now, when I do release my book, which will never happen, like I am a celebrity and people are talking, you know what I mean? Like she's, I just, it's a bit like the Bernice Dallas thing with the serial killers. Like it's this sort of frame of looking at the world that is so bizarre. And it would take me a million years to come up with it, but it makes total sense in the context of their existence. And that's what excites me, I think. Like, I sort of just love that. So I loved that piece of journalism. Yeah.
Well, I was also thinking, the article is by Lily Annalick, isn't it? And she did that incredible podcast, Once Upon a Time at Bennington College, which was all about Bret Easton Ellis and Donna Tartt and, you know, the famous kids from that particular era. So she clearly gets these things as well and obviously is drawn to something similar in them.
Oh, wow. I hadn't even realised the connection there.
Our show will be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes and I'm talking to Caroline O'Donoghue. Can you tell me, Caroline, about a book that made you think about feminism in a new way?
Yeah, I think the first feminist book I ever read, the first like feminist text, I suppose, was Andrea Dworkin's Woman Hating. I think it's out of print now, you know. But I was given it when I was about 17 by a much older friend. And I think I had said something about, you know, the classic young woman thing of not being a feminist or whatever. And he said, well, then try reading this kind of thing. And it couldn't have been more perfect because, first of all, I think like there's something about those second waivers they all have this kind of prose style in common where it's sort of fizzy and intellectual at the same time. And it's very, you can tell that this was a writing style that was developed at like consciousness raising groups because it's heavy on like women's experience, but also being like, men, they're only interested in your, you know, your see you next Tuesday or whatever. They love a four letter word, you know, they're really like spitting bars on the page. And it's kind of, I love that kind of writing. I find it very vervy and fun. Begins with kind of like a deconstruction of like modern fairy tales and how women are positioned in them. And now I think we find that like very, you know, well duh kind of thing. And but for me as a 17-year-old, I had never thought really that like, oh, I think the modern 17-year-old would find this so sort of obvious, but like, oh, the stories all around us and the ways in which we represent women and the way we talk about women in the culture or whatever, it's all part of a larger piece, and that is called misogyny. I don't think I'd ever understood what misogyny was on a cultural level before reading that book. And she starts with this very building blocky thing of like fairy tales, and then she sort of builds it up from there. And it's kind of, as a whole book, it's kind of uneven. Like there's lots of essays that just get super violent and very sweary and very intense out of nowhere, and then she'll go back to some very intellectual chat. But it really just like, it woke me up in a big way at a time in my life where I really needed to be.
I think it's really interesting to think about maybe sort of women of our-ish generation coming to things like you're talking about this, like second wave feminism, at a point when that has sort of already passed by, but we were maybe in that middle ground where there wasn't something as yet that was speaking to us in the same way that there's so much material, I think, available today. Because I think that, you know, I think it comes across a little bit in the Rachel instance as well, that era of being a woman in the sort of early 2000s, being a teenager, when you're almost supposed to be sort of one of the lads, or you don't quite know what your position is. And in essence, I think, you know, you would be, you know, if someone actually, if it came down to it, of course, you're a feminist, you believe in kind of equal rights for women, but it was not a particularly trendy word at the time, right? It wasn't something that we used. And I find looking back on that era now, and the way that I was in those kind of years, really interesting. And I think, you know, and reading exactly the same sort of books, reading second wave feminism, kind of the key texts that didn't necessarily, not everything about them spoke to me, but it is that kind of gateway into thinking like, well, how does this kind of play into my life, and what is important for me? What do I need to learn from this?
Yeah, I find that fascinating as well, that there was like zero feminist discourse, yes, when we were growing up, really. Like, we had girl power, which is great.
Yes.
But I find it fact, I recently did an episode for the podcast on Spice World, the movie, and I, as sort of backup, I was looking at a lot of interviews that Spice Girls gave as a group when they were still a group, the original five. And and it's so interesting how coached it is, because clearly they've been, I mean, they're always themselves, but they were clearly given quite a few strong points by Simon Fuller or whoever. And, you know, radio DJs will say to them, "So girl power, what does that mean to you?" And they'll always say something quite canned, like, "Oh, it just means, you know, being yourself and being strong and being a girl is great," or whatever. And then it'll be like, they'll follow up with like, "Are you feminists? Or where do men play into this? And do you think that women have equal rights?" And they always put up a smoke screen of just like, "Oh, we're just about having a good time. You know, it's like everyone having a good time. You know, girls can kick a ball. Wah," kind of thing. It's like completely devoid of any criticism of misogyny in the culture at all. It's like, and that I think is, girl power was such a wonderful moment to be a child in, but it's, again, it lacked any kind of, that's why we dismiss it now, I guess, because it lacked any kind of kickback at all, you know?
There's nothing behind it. It's just, you know, shouting girl power at each other, and that's it.
But what a time, you know? But that was it, like...
Oh God, yeah, the memories, bring back the, don't bring back the good old days, basically. Now, could you also tell me about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you particularly admire, please?
Do you know what? I thought a lot about this when you sent over the questions in advance of this. And it's so weird. I felt like a sociopath, because obviously there are many women that I admire and whose work I admire. And like, obviously, you know, I could say sort of my mum, or, you know, all that kind of thing. And, or, you know, Zadie Smith, that's a safe choice, you know, like that's, but I don't go in for the admiring so much. Like, there's people whose work I adore, but like, I do think that admiring people should be about certain people witnessed in certain moments who fill you with something sort of fresh and hopeful. And I don't think you should carry around your admiration for years at a time. I don't think you should be going around being like, "Well, it's Hillary Clinton," or, "Well, it's Zadie Smith," or whatever, and, "Oh, well, it's Michelle Obama," or whatever. So anyway, this to say, last week I met a woman on a train, and her name is Lise Doucette. Do you know who that is? She's a Canadian journalist. She's an OBE. She is, you know, a war correspondent and a presenter, and she's done every single job and been to every war zone. And I happened to be sitting next to her on the way home from Hay Festival, because I don't know if you've been to Hay Festival, but it's very much relies on long car journeys, because the festival is about 45 minutes from the local station. And I had never heard of her work before, but I think she's 60 odd or something. But I've never met somebody who's so accomplished, but so generous and so interested and so exciting to be around. And what I feel bad about is that I was so knackered and all I wanted to do was drink this woman and just like ask her about every single thing she'd ever experienced, because she was the most fascinating person I'd ever met, but also go to sleep. And so I ended up coming across, I think, quite rudely, like, because I would just veer between like sort of napping on the train and being like, Lise, tell me about Ukraine kind of thing. And several times people came up to us during this long journey who had recognized her, and she was so gorgeous to all of them. And I just really thought, I was like, I really love her. And I don't know anything about her, and I'll probably never meet her again, but I hope this podcast gets to her somehow. But I thought she was fantastic, and I've been filled with kind of a residual admiration ever since.
And you want to apologize for falling asleep.
And I want to apologize for falling asleep, because I was just so tired. Because I went up, I got up at sort of 7, took the early train to Hay, did my event at 2:30, did a book signing, and then got back on the train. So it was grueling. Just...
Yeah, she'll forgive you. Don't worry. She'll forgive you. And this is interesting. Is it making you, since then, have you wanted to go and kind of read her work? I don't know, does she write? Is it kind of written? She's a presenter.
She doesn't write. I've just been watching her on YouTube, you know, like, okay. Yeah.
Well, there we are. We could all go and Google her after this and, you know, be introduced to her wonderful Lise Doucette. Okay, brilliant. And finally, to celebrate Virago's 50th anniversary, they are publishing 5 new editions of some of their most influential and best beloved books, one for each decade for the imprint, from the 1970s to the present day, which they're calling their golden apples. And so what we're asking guests on the podcast this year to do is to pick their golden apple, by which I mean the one Virago book that you will always recommend to people, can never stop talking about, and wouldn't dream of being without. And which book is yours, Caroline?
It's a bit of an easy one, but it's Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. And obviously, Rebecca is a very famous story. And we, you know, it's one of those books that has sort of bled into the public consciousness, in that, like, if we were at, you know, at a brunch or whatever, and like someone would say, oh, you know, I feel like the second Mrs. Yeah. Winter about this or something, we would all know what that meant, you know, and that's what's great about that. But I sort of read it every few years. And the last time that I read it, I kind of realized that it's such a useful book for now, because it's so much about looking at yourself through other people's eyes. And because I think once you've read that book enough times, and it's so rereadable, you kind of realize that the second Mrs. De Winter, even though she positions herself as being kind of boring and homely, by the way that people sort of like react to her, yes, they're condescending because they're these country English people, but also, you know, people think she's sort of exotic and interesting and sort of whatever, but she always just feels so lonely and so apart from things. And she's constantly comparing herself to an impossible ideal that never really existed to begin with, because, you know, Rebecca was horrible, we learn at the end. And he was right to murder his wife. But I just think it's such an interesting allegory for today, you know, from like, I have social media just like everybody else. And I feel like I'm constantly looking for a first Mrs. De Winter, you know, in that sense.
We all have our first Mrs. De Winters to deal with, right?
Yes, exactly. And it's so much about so much of the social media experience is trying to see yourself through, like, pretending you're other people and trying to look at yourself. And it's that way madness lies. And I think that book proves that point quite well.
Beautifully put. Well, thank you so much, Caroline. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. I've loved this.
Well, thank you everyone else for listening. Our Shelves is brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Caroline O'Donoghue, and tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.